half of disbelief in Allah in the world is caused by people who make religion look ugly due to their bad conduct and ignorance. A quote by Abu Hamid al-Ghazali. It's quite unfortunate that there's lots of confusion today about Islam, what Islam fundamentally is about. People in the West don't understand this very well. And actually, a lot of Islamic people don't understand this very well either. It's kind of funny. There's lots of ideological positions and political debates which take place, which you see in the media, which you can see videos of on YouTube and so forth, and you can read about, and people write about Islam and the problems of radical Islam and all this sort of stuff. And what this turns into is this turns into a sort of like a mirror of the silly one-dimensional debate between science and religion. It's like you got science on one side, religion on the other side, and then you pick a one side and then you fight with the other side. It's this sort of situation which is going on between the East and the Middle East, and it turns into this culture war. And this is very unfortunate because the core of what Islam is lost on 99.9% of people. It's heartbreaking for me to see this, which is why I wanted to shoot this episode, because we're just not taught about this. You're not taught about this in school if you grew up in the West. And this, of course, stems from a couple of factors. It stems from xenophobia. It stems from fear of foreigners. It stems from this sort of tribalist mentality that also goes on in the West, just as it does in the Middle East. But fundamentally, it stems from the problem of not really understanding religion, not understanding the roots of religion and mysticism. And it's actually very simple to understand. Islam, literally in the Arabic language, means submission. That's what Islam means. That tells you what it's about. But submission to what? Is it submission to the ideology of Islam? You might think that that's what that means. But no, that's not what it means. It means the total surrender of oneself to the truth or reality or God. The surrender of one's ego, of one's sense of identity to the larger thing that's going on here. This is God right here. This is reality right here. That's what you're submitting yourself to. Other synonyms for the translation of Islam from the Arabic into the English include words like obedience, peace, and purity. And those are all what come with submission of your ego to God. What we're talking about here is we're talking about self-transcendence, the same as is the goal and objective of Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism and yoga and Zen and every other tradition. It's no different. It's just framed in the style of the Middle East. It's framed from their cultural point of view, based on their values and their traditions and their history. The word Muslim, to be a Muslim, translates as one who submits to God. What many Westerners don't understand about Islam is that Islam is not some separate religion from Christianity or Judaism. Islam recognizes Christian and Jewish prophets like Jesus, Moses, Noah, David, Abraham, and others. It also recognizes the validity of Christian and Jewish sacred texts like the Bible and the Torah and others. So it doesn't reject these. Islam builds on top of them. Islam is really just like the third incarnation of Judeo-Christianity. So you had Judaism, which was like the earliest incarnation. Then, with Jesus, you had the Christian incarnation, which is the second incarnation. It was sort of an innovation on Judaism. And then you had the third innovation, which came with Muhammad. And Muhammad's era was around 600 AD, so 600 years after Jesus. And so the additional extra little twist that Islam adds on top of the Judeo-Christian philosophy is that Muhammad was the final or the last prophet, which ends up being a big problem. Because, of course, like most religious traditions, they try to get a monopoly over the truth, which of course is completely antithetical to the truth. There's no such thing as the last prophet. There will never be a last prophet. You can become enlightened right now and you can be a prophet. There are millions of, well, not millions, but hundreds and maybe thousands even prophets that are alive right now who you can go speak to and visit. And they are as equally spiritually awakened as Muhammad was, at the very least. So by no means was Muhammad actually the last prophet, but in their tradition, that's how they frame it. And also, what Westerners don't understand is that Allah is just another name for the Christian God. It's not some other God that Muslims worship. It's the same Christian God, Allah, the one God. So there's a lot you can learn just by studying the history of Islam, sort of its origin story and the biography of Muhammad and just the historical developments of this tradition, which again is not taught very well in the West, which is why there's a lot of this sort of xenophobic reaction against it, because you're really not taught it unless you go out specifically and you educate yourself, or maybe you took some more advanced classes or some broad ranging classes in university. Like if you were studying comparative religion or something like that, then maybe you learned something about it. But generally, Westerners have a very poor understanding of this topic. I know I did, even though I got a pretty good education, just because this is not part of the core curriculum. What I want to talk about here is I want to talk about several aspects of Islam which can be illuminating for those of us who are into self-development and into self-actualization and spirituality. There's something to be gleaned from almost every mystical tradition and every religion if you know how to see the truth and ignore the corruption and the minutiae. To be sure, there's plenty of corruption within Islam, just as there is with every single religious tradition, just as there is even with science, even in academia and everywhere else. Corruption is not a problem exclusive to Islam. Corruption is a problem that runs rampant throughout every facet of human life. So don't make the mistake of thinking that, oh, well, just because there's corruption here that there's nothing valuable to be gleaned. No. Let's cover some of the different facets that are valuable for our purposes here. So perhaps the most important one of which is jihad. Jihad literally translates from the Arabic to the English as struggle. Jihad is struggle. Now, there's what's known as the lesser jihad and the greater jihad. But really, there's no distinction. There's only one jihad. So jihad means the struggle for what? Is it the struggle to kill your enemies? Is it the struggle to fight over oppression or evil? No. It's the struggle with yourself. It's the struggle with your own ego. It's the struggle with the evil inside of you. There is only one form of evil. There is only one devil, and he is you, the ego. That's it. That's the only struggle that exists in the world. All external struggles, the lesser jihad, as it's known. So the distinction between the lesser and the greater is that the greater jihad is supposed to be the spiritual inner journey to self-realization. Okay. But then there's supposed to be like the lesser jihad, which is what the terrorists and the Muslim radicals are accused of doing. They're accused of engaging in the lesser jihad, which is fighting enemies abroad, fighting enemies who are the infidel, or fighting enemies who are the enemies of Islam, or who are the non-believers, the enemies of Allah. But there's no such thing, because the inner and the outer, the lesser and the greater, these are dualities. All these dualities will collapse and break down. And so really, there's only one jihad. It's the struggle with the self. Any enemies that you have out there, infidels, whatever, they are you without you being conscious of it. So if you actually completed the greater jihad, you would become conscious that there is no difference between the greater and the lesser jihad, and that actually your fighting enemies out there somewhere is you really just fighting with yourself. You're always fighting with yourself. There is nothing but Allah. Allah is the only thing there is. Allah is fighting with itself. Allah can be ignorant or Allah can be awake. When Allah is awake, he stops fighting with himself. When Allah is ignorant and stuck inside of Maya or illusion, then he thinks that there's separation and boundaries and there's us versus them and there's the believers and the disbelievers and we got to punish the disbelievers and fight the disbelievers because they threaten the believers. The fully awakened Allah is not frightened by anything. His faith is unshakable because it's not faith anymore. It's being, it's direct consciousness. Allah is Allah. You can't shake Allah when you realize that you are Allah. So it's all about overcoming your own inner self-deceptions to ultimately transcend the ego and to realize the self, the true self, the infinite self, which is what Allah is. And this is self-actualization. Jihad is nothing other than what actualize.org is about. Jihad is not some radical Islamic philosophy. I mean, it is radical. But it's the essence of every single spiritual path, and it's the essence of self-help and personal development and self-actualization. Actualized.org is jihad. It's a modern version of jihad, framed in a culture and in a way that is suited to the 21st century materialistic, rationalist, secular Western mind. That's what actualize.org is. Ta-da! That's also what Zen is. Zen is jihad. Neo-Advaita is jihad. Advaita Vedanta is jihad. Yoga is jihad. Self-help is jihad. Jed McKenna's work, if you're familiar with his writings, is a very potent form of jihad. What's interesting about Jed McKenna's work is that unlike a lot of other spiritual work, which tends to be very indirect and sort of loosey-goosey and has a lot of fantasies about improving the self and about being spiritual and lovey and dovey and all this sort of stuff, his work is very direct. It cuts the shit. It's very much about the jihad part. He really emphasizes the jihad part. It's a self-annihilation. It's a waging of a war with yourself. And that's very direct, and it's very radical. It is very radical, which is why McKenna's work is polarizing. People either love it or they hate it. Because either you're at the point where you can do a direct jihad, or you're at the point where you can't. And 99% of people in the world can't. They're not ready to surrender their ego. They're not even ready to hear about it or to even read about that possibility. But then those who are, and that's a very direct path. If you can just go and straight up wage a full-on war with yourself and burn yourself alive in the spiritual fires. So if you resonate with Jed McKenna's work well, then you understand jihad very well. The other spiritual traditions tend to emphasize the jihad component less, because what does the ego hate the most? The ego hates the most its own power being threatened. So most spiritual traditions, what they actually do is they try to trick the ego into doing spiritual work. They don't tell the ego that you're outright going to kill yourself. They don't tell you that, because if they tell you that, then no one's going to listen. No one wants that. No one's going to buy into your spirituality if you tell them that. So instead, what you do is you tell them the opposite. You tell them, oh, you're going to grow yourself. Life's going to become more beautiful and this and more loving and you're going to have more power and more this. And so you tell the ego all the stuff it wants to hear. Because as the ego then gets going into the practices, as it starts doing yoga and meditation and self-inquiry and all this, then it slowly starts to realize, like, holy shit, I'm actually going to kill myself. But by that point, it's sort of already like, well, I've already been doing this for a couple of years. I'm already sort of bought into it. Fine, fuck it. I'll just carry it. But it still doesn't really understand. The ego will only understand what it really means to die after it's dead. And that's such a radical thing that if the ego knew about it beforehand, it would never go there. It can't go there. So many spiritual paths, what they do, because most people are not ready for a true jihad, what they do is they have to do a gradual ramp up. So most spiritual teachings are weak sauce. They're not strong sauce. It's weak sauce for the ego. It's a little bit of like, oh, just meditate to relax, to melt away your stress, or do this technique, this breathing technique. It'll help to calm your monkey mind. That's sort of like how it starts, right? It's the ego looking to improve itself, thinking that, oh, I can do spirituality, but still stay fundamentally in power. I can still stay alive. I can improve my self-image. I can become this enlightened master or this spiritual guru type person. And that, oh, that's a nice image to aspire to. But of course, what's not realized is that in the end, you will lose absolutely everything. You will surrender everything. There will be nothing of you left. All self-images will be broken and completely shattered. And your entire notion of reality will collapse and you will die. And then that will be your awakening, is your death. But that doesn't compute for the selfish mind. And even self-help, even stuff like what Tony Robbins teaches, and just, you know, lots of self-help is just about giving you career advice, business advice, relationship advice, this sort of flimsy type of advice. That's all good. But ultimately, that is also jihad. It's just a very gradual form of jihad, such that most people who are even teaching self-help, kind of basic self-help, they don't even realize what they're really teaching. They think they're teaching self-improvement. And in a sense, they are. But ultimately, that self-improvement is leading you up Maslow's hierarchy, ultimately to self-transcendence. And that's, in our current culture and era, that's what most people can handle. They can't handle any more than that. Now, of course, if you can handle more than that, then go for the direct jihad approach. And actualize.org is kind of somewhere in the middle. I don't try to beat you over the head with jihad too much because I know that most people aren't gonna buy into it. The more you stress the jihad, the smaller your spiritual audience will grow. I mean, will shrink. It'll shrink down smaller and smaller and smaller. And basically, you're going to have a very hardcore teaching for a very small number of people who are extremely serious about this work. That's sort of what happens with Jed McKenna. And then the less you emphasize jihad, the more people will be attracted to you because their egos come flocking to spirituality because they want to have a spiritualized ego. Now, of course, the way that the devil works is that it turns everything backwards and inside out, 180 degrees. So when you hear jihad in the news or in mainstream culture, you hear it as the exact opposite of what I'm describing. You hear it as selfishness. You hear it as people engaging in violence and in warfare and in hatred and in condemnation of other groups and in judging others and waging jihad against them. That's what the devil does. See my video, What is the Devil? To explain the tricks of the devil. But the devil works through illusion and self-deception. And so what the devil does is he will take the truth, he will take the most potent forms of spirituality, and he will corrupt them inside out, which is exactly what happens with Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, and all the other isms that are out there. Because the greatest threat to the devil is the truth. So he has to take control over any mechanisms which might reveal the truth too directly. It's too direct. So why is there this corruption and this misunderstanding of what Islam is? It's because when a spiritual teaching is too direct, it gets corrupted. The more mainstream it gets, it becomes the enemy of its own success. There are supposed to be like 2 billion Muslims in the world right now, and it's a quickly growing religion. So anything that appeals to 2 billion people has to be very, very diluted and watered down, and actually it has to be very materialistic, which is why the lesser jihad is a materialistic form of the greater jihad. You see, materialism is about fighting in this physical world, whereas the greater jihad is fighting within yourself and attaining the spiritual world, the spiritual realms. The word Allah means God, of course, but it also means really absolute infinity. not God as a man in the clouds with a beard, but Allah as this thing right here. What science calls reality, that's what Islam calls Allah. What the atheist calls the Big Bang or reality, this very present moment that's happening right now, objective physical reality, that's what the atheist refers to as Allah. But the atheist isn't conscious, the scientist isn't conscious of the full significance of what the word reality really means and what it really is. It's absolute infinity. That's what Allah is. In Islam, they have what's called the 99 names of Allah. These are titles that are given to Allah, which describe the various properties and characteristics of Allah. And this can be quite illuminating. You can go to Wikipedia, type in 99 names of Allah, and you will get this list. I want to read you some of the names from this list because this describes exactly what Allah is. The King, the Peace, the Holy, the Controller, the Supreme, the Creator, the All-Knowing, the All-Seeing, the All-Aware, the Magnificent, the Sublime, the Vast, the Wise, the Witness, the Truth, the Reality, the One, the Perceiver, the Indivisible, the All-Powerful, the Beginningless, the Endless, the Hidden, the Good, the Light, the Beautiful, the Patient, the Guide, the Giver of Life, and the Taker of Life, and the Infinite. This is just a partial listing. You can find the full list on Wikipedia if you're curious. So all of these accurately describe the properties of Allah. These are the properties of reality when you have a direct consciousness of what reality is as a whole, and not just some fragment in the way that science, for example, studies it, or the way that atheists understand it. When you actually experience Allah, and it's possible to have a direct experience of Allah because that's exactly what you are Allah, you will understand that all of these perfectly describe Allah. Perfectly. When I was reading this list, it actually brought me to tears because when I was reading it online, because I'm reading it and it's my direct experience that is being described here. It's a perfect description, a perfect description. And the reason I'm telling you this is because people think that, oh, but Islam is so corrupt. Yes, it's corrupt in many ways, but don't lose the core that's there. The core there contains some deep truth, which is why Islam is so entrenched, which is why people don't give up Islam. See, a lot of atheists and scientifically minded Western people, secular people, they look at Islamic people and Islamic countries and they say, well, why don't they just give all this up? It's just silly ideas and myths and stories, and it's all just nonsense, and it's filled with corruption, and it promotes violence and all of this. No, that's because you're not seeing through to the truth there. All you're seeing is just the pure corruption. And of course, when you're just seeing the pure corruption, then you're going to have the opinion that, oh, it's just nonsense. You should just throw it all away. Better to do away with it. But the people who see the truth in it and who've had these direct experiences, they're never going to give it up. Never. Because they know the power of the truth that's there. Now, of course, what a lot of them don't know is that that truth is equally there in many other traditions through many other forms, including in Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, yoga, Zen. I mean, this, you name it, there's so many. Shamanism, psychedelics, just a plain old-fashioned contemplation or meditation can get you there. There's so many ways to get there. Islam is certainly not the way, not the best way, not the only way. Another interesting concept that I love in Islam is this notion of the 72 virgins. Have you heard of this? You heard of terrorists expecting 72 virgins after they blow themselves up and this sort of stuff? And that might seem like, oh, that's just some silly nonsense. How could anybody believe that and then blow themselves up over that? But actually, after you experience Allah directly for yourself, you will understand that this 72 virgins is a very accurate metaphor. for the magnificence of Allah. What you have to understand is you have to understand where Islam came from, its cultural context, its historical context. This metaphor of the 72 virgins is perfect for the context in which Allah was developed. When was Allah developed? Where was it developed? Not in America, not in the 21st century with the internet and with television and with video games, okay? This was developed in 600 AD in Arabia. Do you know, have you studied the history of 600 AD Arabia? Do you know the kind of things that went on there? Do you know the kind of mindsets that that culture had? What their values were? Take a hypothetical Arabian man in 600 AD. A wealthy man. He's probably a caravan trader, let's say. And he delivers spices along the Silk Road and other places through the Middle East. Maybe he trades with people in Africa and Europe and in India. And so he's a business person. He's a trader. He has a caravan. He has a big family he has to take care of. He probably has multiple wives, as was the custom of that time. He has to take care of all of them. He has to take care of his thriving caravan trade. And he's interested in what? What is he interested in? He's interested in acquiring more wives. He's interested in beautiful horses. He's interested in finding new spices and new trade routes and acquiring gold and trading. You know, he's engaged in the pragmatics of living back then. That's how people lived. He's also concerned about tribal warfare because the region he lived in, and at that time, tribal warfare was rampant. There were feuds between neighboring tribes and even large families because Arabian culture is a strongly familial culture. Family is very, very important. It's one of the most important values. But then, of course, they have family feuds. They have these long extended families, so they're battling with each other. So that's what his mind is focused upon. Now, let's say that I am some Arabian prophet who has experienced Allah, and now I come to this Arabian businessman, this caravan trader, and I tell him, hey, there's this magnificent thing called Allah. You've got to experience this. Come with me. Start meditating. Here's some practices. Start to do this, and you will experience Allah, the most magnificent thing. And the Arabian man will look at me and say, the caravan trader will say, but, I mean, how is this going to improve my life? How is this practical? This isn't practical at all. Is this going to get me more camels? Is it going to get me better horses? Is this going to get me more women for my harem? Is this going to get me more spices? Is this going to help me? How's this going to help me with the feuds that I'm fighting with? I need warriors for my feuding. And that's where I will come up with a metaphor to help to explain to him the magnificence of the absolute. And I will say, ah, you know what it's like? Allah is like 72 virgins. It's like having 72 virgins in your harem. And now the caravan trader will get it. That's a metaphor he can relate to in his time, in his culture, in the stuff that he's engaged in at the time. Now, of course, today in the West, in the 21st century, this doesn't make any sense. But back then, in that context, it made perfect sense. And if you ever happen to have the glory of experiencing Allah for yourself, you will actually see that it's more magnificent than having 72 virgins in a harem. I'm telling you, that's a dead accurate metaphor, and actually, it will be way better than that. Experience it for yourself, and then you will see how appropriate that metaphor is. The mistake that people make when they are thinking about religion and spiritual and mystical traditions is that they take them out of the historical and cultural context, especially today because we have a global world. And it might seem because our world is global and you can watch YouTube videos from around the world and the internet connects us all that, oh, now we sort of understand each other globally. But no, we don't. We really don't. Because, first of all, you don't understand even a fraction, not even 1% of the cultures that exist around the world today in the 21st century. You don't understand. You have no experience with them at all. And they would completely blow your mind and shatter your reality if you were exposed to them. But, and that's not even taking into account the historical evolution of cultures that happened over centuries and millennia, like we're talking about here. See? So you have to understand where the tradition is coming from, what its origins were, and then it starts to make a lot more sense. Another interesting facet of Islam is that there are no images of Allah or Muhammad within Islam. This is very different from the Christian tradition, where we actually have art going back for centuries and for millennia, depictions of Christ and Mary and even God, you know, Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, where you have David and God, or Adam and God, and all this, and they have depictions of God as the white, in the white flowing robes and the white beard, sitting up in the heavens with angels and all this sort of stuff. You don't get that in Islam. And actually, Islam is very sensitive to that, which you might have heard of about in the news. You know, people fighting with violence over cartoon drawings of Muhammad and all this sort of stuff. But what's the deeper truth there? Why is Allah and Muhammad not allowed to be depicted? Why is there a taboo against imagery in Islam? Because the map is not the territory. Because the mind gets hooked on images and icons, and then it starts to worship those images and those icons. But Allah is not any particular image or icon or form. Allah is the formless. Allah is nothingness. Infinity is nothingness. So in a sense, to maintain the purity of the teaching, you don't want to corrupt the teaching by putting pictures of Allah everywhere, or Muhammad, because people will then start to worship that, rather than seeing Allah as what's here right now, in the present moment. And that's been a big problem for Christianity. The iconography within Christianity, arguably, all the European art that's been done over the last 1,000 years around Christianity, has done a great disservice to Christianity. Because most people today, most Christians, when you ask them what is God, they have an image of God as this man sitting up in the clouds. And that's a delusion. And they don't understand that's a delusion. So you can see that actually there's a good intention behind this idea of not depicting Allah or Muhammad. Because all symbols are not the absolute. And we've talked about that a lot before. So you can appreciate that. You can appreciate how all my talking about the map is not the territory and Gödel's incompleteness theorem and all this, how it all starts to connect together. What they do have in Islam, though, for art, is they have geometric patterns. These sort of tessellations or these fractals. Interesting and various geometric patterns. That, in a sense, is one way to depict Allah without creating a human image of it, without anthropomorphizing Allah the way that Christians do. And it's actually a pretty ingenious solution to this problem. These geometric patterns actually align very well with what you see on psychedelics. And also, they represent infinity, because once you have a checkerboard, some other kind of pattern, hexagonal pattern, it just kind of goes on in all directions infinitely. And that is a symbol, a pointer towards Allah. Another feature of Islam is that they pray 5 times a day. Why 5 times a day? Why so much? Well, it's because of this important other concept within Islam, which is called forgetfulness. Islam recognizes, as basically all spiritual traditions do, the fact that we fall back asleep so easily. The human mind falls back asleep into complacency and into materialism. And so what needs to be happening is you need to be waking up all the time. You don't just have one enlightenment experience and that's it. It's like you got to be awake all the time, 5 times a day, 20 times a day. Keep waking yourself up. Keep being mindful because you forget. And if you had a mystical experience of your own, maybe you take a psychedelic trip or maybe you've had some awakening experience during a meditation retreat or something like that, great. But then you know what the problem is. The problem is you come back the next day and you've forgotten. Where did it go? Where did my mystical experience go? How come I'm not in union anymore? How come I don't see Allah right now? How come I'm out of touch with it? Because you've forgotten. Not forgotten in the sense that you can't remember, but you've lost touch with the awareness right now. You've gone from mindfulness into mindlessness, and now you're in mindlessness. And so the point of prayer 5 times a day is so that you don't get so wrapped up in your day doing practical stuff, materialistic stuff, the way that most Westerners do. Think of a typical Westerner stockbroker on Wall Street. What's he doing his whole day? He's chasing money and sex and drugs. That's what he's doing all day. And power and political influence. So the intention behind Islam is like, well, what if we interrupted his day 5 times and got him to actually focus on the more subtle, the more spiritual aspects of life? Like, for example, what if we just took a stockbroker and we forced him to stop 5 times a day because we had a clock that just rang for everybody? So all of Wall Street would just stop 5 times a day for 10 minutes. And every single stockbroker on Wall Street, they thought about their own death. They thought about the suffering of humanity. They thought about what they're doing with their life and whether their pursuit of materialistic goods and pleasures is leading them towards actual happiness. And they calmed their mind down and they stepped outside of their cravings and all the stuff they're chasing, the hustle and bustle of everyday life, of all the practical stuff, and they just basked in the beingness of the present moment. What would happen then? Well, of course, then all of Wall Street would collapse after a few years of that. So that's no good. So we can't have that on Wall Street. But you understand the intention now. A little bit about Muhammad. Muhammad is the prophet. He's supposed to have written the Quran, but he didn't write it himself. He's supposed to have channeled it from a higher source. The question is, was Muhammad enlightened? And I think almost certainly he was. The only question is to what degree. There are various degrees of enlightenment, various degrees of realization, various facets of realization that you can become conscious of. I don't know. It's hard to judge. But since he spoke about the absolute so eloquently, and since it seems like he had an understanding of the absolute from direct experience, I don't see otherwise how he could have spoken it with such passion and such commitment. That it seems like he was enlightened. He did go and meditate in a cave by himself. That's part of his origin story. And it seems like he had mystical experiences throughout his whole life. Not just once or twice, but later into his later years, he basically composed the Quran and other writings for like 20 or 30 or 40 years of his life. He lived a pretty long life after his initial awake, well, I would consider an awakening. He's also supposed to have communicated or channeled the angel Gabriel. And you might say, well, that's surely nonsense, Leo. That's just stories. That's just fiction. Don't be so sure about that. As you get deeper into these mystical experiences, you start to discover that you can channel entities. I've got books on my bookshelf that teach you how to channel. If you want to learn how to channel, you can go spend 30, 60 days doing these practices. You can learn how to channel. You can connect with different entities and this sort of stuff. You can take DMT and you can see alien entities and they will be more lifelike than human beings that you see right here, right now. And you could find YouTube videos of people who channel, like you got Bashar and other folks like that who are into channeling. So channeling is a real phenomenon. You can go learn it, experience it for yourself. It's definitely possible. It's a common ability that gets developed by people who do serious, hardcore spiritual practices. So totally plausible that that's how the Quran came about. I encourage you to actually go study the origin story of Muhammad. Not per se the myths of it, but like the historical the historical, like, what are the historical facts that we know? Just to kind of like get inside his head to see where he was coming from. And also to learn about the culture and the context that he was dealing with at that time. It's very eye-opening. I want to stress that you don't get lost in the minutia of debating about the niggly little details about Islam. That's very easy to do. It's very easy to do that with almost anything. You can always find fine points to criticize here and there and different things that are corrupt here and there. Oh, I don't like this. I don't like that. Is this really true? Is this an embellishment? Is this an elaboration? Is this a thing, a lie? Yeah, there's probably plenty of that in Islam. But you want to go to the big picture. Because what happens otherwise is that you're lost in the minutia. The people, most of the people, most of the Westerners who like to debate and criticize Islam do so without ever having a direct experience of Allah, which is utterly absurd, because you can't criticize this thing, you can't really understand what this thing is about without having a direct experience of Allah first. So first go experience that, then start leveling your criticisms. So people like Bill Maher, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and others like that, they love to criticize and rag on Islam, but they've never actually experienced Allah. So they don't really understand the depth of what they're criticizing. Which is not to say that all their criticisms are invalid. Some of their criticisms are totally valid. It's completely correct that modern day Islam and countries and people who subscribe to Islam, that those people do all sorts of violations of human rights and civil rights, and they can form dictatorial regimes, and they can do all sorts of nasty stuff. Of course. But that's not exclusive just to them. That happens everywhere, all around the world. There's corruption all around the world. Every single government is basically corrupt, especially the U.S. government is extremely corrupt, and we do all sorts of heinous things against all sorts of people in the name of American patriotism, in the name of Christianity, in the name of Judaism, in the name of anything. Because that's ego. That's how ego functions. That's not a problem of Islam. That's a problem of ego. That's a problem of dogma and fundamentalism. Now you might ask, well, Leo, why is Islam so corrupt? Why is it so archaic? You have to understand that every spiritual teaching has to be suited to the era, the culture, and the geography from which it came about. This spiritual teaching, as I've said, is suited to 600 AD Arabia. If Islam was invented today, it would look like actualize.org. It would not look like traditional Islam. And conversely, if actualize.org was invented in 600 AD Arabia, for that era, for that geography, for that culture, it would look something like Islam. Because if I try to say the things that I'm trying to say now, there, in that era, it would completely not resonate, and I would get killed. And also because I would have grown up in that culture, so I would have a totally different set of values than I do as an American in the 21st century. And also, of course, because we knew a lot less about the world than we know now. The world was a lot less globalized. The problem is that people cling to spiritual tradition. They try to take a spiritual tradition that is thousands of years old, and they try to maintain it as an orthodoxy. They try to maintain it and apply it to today. But today is different. In 1,000 years, a lot of stuff changes. We learn more stuff. We get new developments in science. We get globalization happening. We get new technologies. We get changes in morality. We get changes in values and culture. Changes in government. Radical, radical, radical changes. We get changes even in our DNA, in our genetics, in the functioning of our brains, our brain chemistry. We get changes in the food that we eat, the air that we, like, so many changes, almost everything has changed. We also have a much deeper historical context into which to put the spiritual traditions. So in a sense, society has evolved. So what really needs to happen is that these spiritual traditions also need to evolve. They need to be fresh, because spirituality is about the present, moment, the truth. The truth is only happening in the present. How do you connect yourself with the truth? To answer that question, you must ask first the question, what are the obstacles that are preventing me from connecting to the truth? And what are the obstacles? The obstacles are usually the social ones, the cultural ones. It's your social upbringing, your culture, your education that gets in the way. So the obstacles that existed 1,500 years ago in Arabia are different obstacles than exist today in 21st century America, for example, where people are jerking off to porn and watching YouTube videos nonstop and playing video games. That shit, those obstacles did not exist back then. So a lot of the corruption stems from the mind being ideological and wanting to cling to tradition and not letting these traditions evolve as they need to. This is a problem that's not just exclusive to Islam. It's also there in Christianity, in Judaism. It's even there in science. You think science and atheism is immune to this? Not at all. It suffers from exactly the same problem. Atheists cling to their dogmas, and scientists cling to their paradigms just as much. And a lot of problems get created because of that. You have to understand that 600 AD Arabia was very conservative, very traditional. It was extremely tribal. It was very combative. There was no unifying element at that time within Arabia. And so Islam was actually a huge innovation at that time. It brought peace and stability to the region that otherwise was slitting each other's throats over family feuds that went back hundreds and maybe thousands of years, that you were killing and slaughtering your family members in these feuds in that era without even know why you're slaughtering them. You're just slaughtering them just because that's what your culture was at the time. And people were worshiping different deities in that region. There was no unifying force. And there was no notion of peace and compassion and love. And you might think, well, but Islam doesn't teach about peace and compassion and love, because today we know Islam is this sort of violent tradition. But back then, you have to understand that it's all relative. So back then, the violence was so extreme that what Islam actually brought was a stabilizing and peaceful influence. It actually taught that there's something larger that's connecting all of these tribes together. And so under this banner, Muhammad was actually able to unify the entire region. And that was a huge technological innovation at the time. See, we tend to forget, we think of technology as machines and cars and computers and internet and smartphones. That's today's technology. But some of the biggest innovations of technology weren't machines. They were social innovations. They were cultural innovations. They were spiritual, religious innovations. And Islam was one of those at that time. Now, of course, today, when you bring that when you bring that technology into today without adjusting it, without knowing how to read its intent, how to take the truth out of it, but leave behind the old antiquated things in the Quran, for example, which don't make sense today. If you're a literalist, if you're too literal about following the Quran, if you're too orthodox about it, then what's going to happen is you're going to bring that culture and the problems of 600 AD Arabia into today's world. And that doesn't work. So the problem is that you have to let these traditions evolve. And the mind has a big problem with evolution, because the whole point of the ego is to prevent evolution. What is ego? Ego is just a structure that's trying to maintain itself as it is. So by definition, any change that comes to this structure, the ego is going to reject, and it's going to bristle at, it's going to feel afraid of, and it's going to want to be orthodox. It's going to want to stay the same. But then, of course, all of life is always changing, so you don't really have an option to stay the same. Everything is going to change. Everything is going to evolve. You're not going to maintain your orthodoxies. And the more you try to maintain your orthodoxies, the more it actually backfires on you. Which is much smarter is to be proactive about evolving along with the times. And also, if you want to maintain the spirit of your orthodoxies and your traditions, you can do that. But to do that, you have to read between the lines and see what the intent, the spiritual heart and core and the intent was of the teaching, which is what this episode is about. If you've got the heart of Islam, you don't need to follow the Quran to the letter. It doesn't matter at all. You can throw the Quran away when you've got the heart. When you become Allah, it doesn't matter. You don't need to read the Quran anymore, ever. Now, to many Muslims, that will sound like sacrilege, like heresy. That's because that's what orthodoxy is. That's what happens when you take spiritual scriptures too literally. That's always been the problem. Christians have taken spiritual scriptures too literally. Hindus have, and Jews and everybody else. It's just a common problem because the egoic mind, the selfish mind, it's materialistic. It wants to find authority figures that it can latch onto because that's how it gets a sense of its reality and stability. Whereas to awaken is to realize that there is no stability at all, that Allah is infinitely groundless, that there's no beginning or end to it, and that there's no foundation to anything, and therefore you're completely liberated. And ironically, that's what many religious people are afraid of, because remember how the religion was sold in the first place. It was sold to billions and millions of people by watering it down, by making it palatable to the ego. And in a sense, the devil has co-opted the teaching precisely so that it leads you in the exact opposite direction of awakening. And that's why you see so much hypocrisy within religion. It's because, it's not because the religion is false. It's actually because the religion is true. It's precisely because it's so true. It's precisely because the techniques are so powerful that they need to be corrupted. They're too powerful. That's the delicious irony of how the devil works. Now you might say, but Leo, aren't you defending Islamic fundamentalism here? And of course, the answer is no. What I'm talking about is developing a higher understanding. What we need is not to start attacking people or attacking traditions. What we need is we need more common understanding to see that all religions and all traditions and even secular foundations and organizations, they all basically have one common goal. When you truly understand that, you soften with compassion. You no longer snipe at the other side. You no longer play these tribal ideological games that are played between science and religion, between Christianity and Islam and the West and the East. This is all silly. This is all just part of the problem. For example, the West will criticize the Middle East for fighting with each other. They'll say, oh, well, there's the Sunnis and the Shiites. Why are they fighting and slaughtering each other? It's so silly. It's just tribal warfare. Stop that. Why do they do that? Why don't they just stop? I mean, after all, they're both Muslims. Sunnis and Shiites are both Muslims. They just have slight different interpretations of the chronology and the historical developments of, you know, whose ancestor was who and who was closer to Muhammad and all this. Was it the uncle or the father or the son-in-law and all this? Like, yeah, there's these technicalities. But see, when you get lost in those technicalities, then that's what happens. You develop this kind of tribal conflict. But then that happens still with the West and the East. That happens. The West and the Middle East. Same thing happens. When you zoom out, you take a larger perspective, you wonder, but why is the West and the Middle East fighting? they're both talking about exactly the same thing. They're both trying to realize truth, just in different ways. They're confused about what they're doing. Now you might say, but Leo, isn't Islam dangerous? Well, this question of danger is really interesting. Because a lot of people think that the world is going to come to an end through terrorism or through religious radicals and fundamentalists. But consider that actually the greatest danger to the world is not Islamic radicals or religion, but actually it's the opposite. It's materialism. If the world comes to an end in the next 100 years, most likely it will be because of materialism run amok. It will be because of rampant secularism, rampant rationalism, rampant corporate greed, which is fueled by those, nuclear war, which is, again, fueled by the technology and the rationalism and the corporate greed that is infecting our government, by global warming, which is also fueled by the same, and maybe perhaps by some new technological development like artificial intelligences, which take over and then all hell breaks loose. These will not get developed or triggered by Islamic radicals. These are going to come from Western culture, not from Middle Eastern culture. Middle Eastern culture is not going to develop an AI that's going to kill us all. But Western culture might. Middle Eastern culture doesn't have that many nukes. Western culture has a lot more nukes. And we look, actually, especially lately, what you see in the news, I mean, we look very trigger happy to use them. Much more so than many Middle Eastern countries. Global warming. Corporate greed. The deep irony is that the thing that the radical Islamic terrorists are concerned about is actually legitimate. What are they concerned about? They are concerned about the West's influence over the world, and specifically the Middle East. They are concerned about the spread of rampant materialism and secularism, and how that's having a corrupting influence on their local culture, but also culture at large. And they are seeing that their culture and their religion is getting swamped over by this toxic form of materialism. Now, of course, their reaction to it is also materialistic and therefore problematic. It's contributing to the problem. But they are quite right that materialism is a problem. So in a sense, the West is worried that the Islamics will take over and they will end the world. But the Islamics are worried that it's the West that's taking over and it's going to destroy the world. Who's more right? You might think, like, well, of course the West. What's the problem with the West? But that's because you haven't studied really deeply the evils of the West. The West is extremely evil. This corporate greed, it's not merely greed. It's not merely people who are after making millions and billions of dollars. It goes way deeper than that. The evil of the greed that we see, especially running rampant in America, is a huge, huge, huge corrupting factor. Huge. It corrupts everything. It corrupts education, corrupts healthcare, it corrupts marketing, it corrupts food, it corrupts your health. Like, I mean, there's almost no end in sight to the corruption that comes with this. We have record numbers of depressed people, record numbers of suicidal people, record numbers with PTSD suffering from all these problems, all relationship problems, marriage problems, you know, all this. What's this coming from? It's coming from materialism. It's coming from a lack of self-actualization. And it seems to only be getting worse because, for example, Western society is becoming more and more secular, more and more materialistic. So in a sense, these Islamic radicals have a reason to be concerned, because what they're concerned about is that that will come and take over their region, their village, their city, their country. And I didn't even start mentioning all the ways in which the Western powers meddle in Middle Eastern affairs and geopolitics and screwing and manipulating their elections and all of that. So that's like kicking the hornet's nest, you know, adding insult to injury. Now, you might still say, but Leo, shouldn't we still fight radical fundamental? What do you want me to do? Do you want us to just do nothing, sit back and do nothing and let the terrorists run amok? No, what we need is we need a very intelligent approach to this problem. We need to understand the roots of the problem. And we need to understand that our superficial solutions, our knee-jerk reactions to go bomb somebody, to attack somebody, to criticize somebody, that actually could be backfiring on us and contributing to the problem. What you need to do is you first need to understand why fundamentalism exists in the first place at a very deep level. This is an epistemic question. This is a question of all the stuff that I've been talking about, concepts like webs of belief and paradigms and dogma and ideology and how the mind works, the self-deceptive characteristics of the mind. And then what you need to see, you need to see that this fundamentalism actually is a condition of the egoic mind. materialistic egoic minds are fundamentalist. We have a lot of fundamentalism here in the West. It just takes a different form and style. For example, the most prevalent form of fundamentalism in the West is capitalism. This blind belief that capitalism will solve all problems. That's fundamentalism. And it leads to a lot of evil. You think communism leads to evil? Yes, it does. And I'm not saying communism is the solution, but what we need to see is also that capitalism leads to also a lot of evil. A lot of the evil of capitalism is hidden and buried under the surface. You have to research it to really see just how much evil there is there. The solution isn't to wage a battle over communism or capitalism or Christianity or Islam or science versus religion. The solution is to start to see that it's the ego mind that's responsible, and to start to see that it's all happening within yourself and that it's not separate from you, that you are contributing to the problem. You, the American taxpayer or the European taxpayer, you're contributing to the problem. The ideas and opinions you hold, how you understand yourself and how you understand the world, this is all contributing to the problem. This corrupting force, it's within you. It's not in some other tribe or some other nation. It's within you. You are the source of the corruption. You are the source of the evil. And that is not going to stop, no matter what you do externally, until you take care of your ego, which is what Islam is trying to get you to do. You must slay the fundamentalism inside of yourself. And fundamentalism is a lot more tricky of a problem than most people think, because a lot of Westerners, secular, rational, scientifically minded people, think that they are immune to the problem of fundamentalism. And of course, that just makes them all the more susceptible. Because now there's the additional hurdle of convincing these people who think they're immune, they are believing that fundamentally, they think that they are not fundamentalists, but they're fundamental about thinking that they're not fundamentalists, and then I have to convince them that they actually are fundamentalists, and of course they are going to be fundamentalists and deny that they're fundamentalists. The whole point of fundamentalism is that you deny that you're fundamentalist, regardless of what the content of your fundamentalism is, whether it's science, religion, rationality, or capitalism, communism, or anything else. So, again, very ironically, the West is committing the very same problem that the Middle East is committing. They are waging a lesser jihad. The United States government is waging a lesser jihad against the jihadis in the Middle East. And the jihadis in the Middle East are waging a lesser jihad against Western powers. And that's not going to fly. It doesn't work. It just keeps the cycle going. That's a feud. That's a family feud is what that's known as. That's not going to fix it. You need to now rise to the higher level to see the commonalities. In the same way that Muhammad introduced Islam in 600 AD in Arabia, and that elevated them to see commonality where there was just infighting and tribalism, the same thing now needs to happen between Islam in the Middle East and in the West. East and West needs to come together. You need to recognize that all external fighting is really just a distraction from the greater jihad of turning inwards. If every U.S. president engaged in the greater jihad within himself, there would be no Middle Eastern wars. There would be no lesser jihads. The lesser jihads are precisely because these people do not engage in the greater jihad. And likewise, the same thing with the leaders in the Middle East, leaders who are organizing these campaigns to fight and to kill people and to blow people up and all this sorts of stuff. It's the same problem. They're fighting the problem externally, when really the devil is inside of you. You are the devil. So when are you going to wake up to that? and take control of the real problem. I highly encourage you to study the history of Muhammad and Islam. And towards that end, what I would recommend for you is a teaching company lecture series called Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad. That's its title. Go into Google, type in the teaching company, type in Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, and this thing will pop up. You can buy this course from them. It's not very expensive. It's a really good course. It's this like 40-hour-long lecture series covering these four religious leaders. But specifically, I want you to start and to focus on Muhammad. It's especially good. There's about 10 videos that they have there which describe the origin story of Muhammad and how he founded Islam, his trials and tribulations. It's really fascinating. It's very eye-opening, and it'll put all of this into context in a way that will probably blow your mind if you're like the typical Western person who's just ignorant of this history. It'll really help you to understand. But that's it for now. I hope this has changed your mind a little bit, shifted your perspective on how to view Islam. Please click like button for me and come check out actualize.org. I got some exclusive content there for you to check out. Check out my blog. Check out the Life Purpose course. Check out the book list. Check out the forum where you can discuss these topics with like-minded people. And lastly, just stay tuned with me. Because as actualize.org continues, we're going to be building more bridges between different traditions. Religious traditions, mystical traditions, but also secular traditions. What we need more and more of in today's world, as we're becoming more globalized, and we can't stop the globalization from happening any more than we can stop the internet from happening, or that we can stop driving cars from happening. Cars will be driving themselves in the next 20 to 50 years. And we all will be here. We all need to get along with each other. We all need to start to understand each other. And that comes from building bridges between these different traditions. That's, in a sense, what gets me the most excited, is shooting topics where we interconnect stuff that usually people never interconnect. Like, we interconnect mathematics and non-duality, or logic and religion, or science and Islam. You know, you can interconnect all these things. They are connected. Everything is connected in some way. And what you'll find, actually, is that studying all these different religious traditions, it might seem like it's irrelevant, it's unnecessary. Sure, you don't strictly need it. If you want to go get enlightened, if you want to go do the great jihad and you're ready for it, and you know you don't want any distractions, by all means, go do it. But there's still something valuable that you'll miss from studying all these different traditions, all these different perspectives. There's something of value. Not everything. Not everything there is perfect. There's a lot of bullshit, a lot of nonsense, a lot of corruption. You have to learn how to pick out the gold and leave behind the shit. You have to get good at that. Because if your criteria is that you're only going to read a book if it's pure gold and it's completely factually true and there's no nonsense in it at all, well, you're going to rob yourself of a lot of learnings and lessons. It's rare to find a book where you can agree with everything written in the book and it's perfectly correct and true. Under that definition, you shouldn't read most science books. All right? People like to think, oh, but science is the gold standard. No, it's not. It's full of so much dogma and fundamentalism and inaccuracies that don't even get me started on that shit. All right? You have to be very careful with how you read scientific studies, how you read scientific textbooks, how you interpret them, how you think about the ramifications of what that means for life and for society and for government and for technology and for lots of other stuff. Just like you have to do with reading spiritual books. You can't be literalist. You have to learn how to read between the lines, think for yourself, think outside the box. You have to be very creative and very open. You have to be fluid and fresh. That's the essence of spirituality. It's consciousness. You have to be conscious. If you're doing spirituality or you're doing science or you're doing anything else without consciousness, you're gonna create a mess. So if you stick around with me, I will help you to draw more of those interconnections as we go along.